Okay, let's see. Can I hear you?
Pardon? Can I hear you? No, but can you hear me?
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
Oh, now I can.
Okay.
Yes, okay. So today is April 3rd, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein here in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we are continuing our Dave Klein life history conversations. So last week, we talked about your deer research work in southeastern Alaska and graduate school, and I think we kind of finished that up and moving on to, I think you then started working in Juneau. Is that what came next?
1 year, yeah. After I finished up the residency at the University of British Columbia, then in 1961, the whole family drove back up over the highway in May, which was early over the highway, to Carcross, where we could take a train and put the car on a flat bed to Skagway and catch the ferry to Juneau. That's the only way we could get there, because there was no road to Valdez or to Haines at the time, or Skagway.
And there was no ferry up from Prince Rupert or Seattle?
It might have been, but probably not. No, I don't think there was. The ferry system hasn't developed. There was this, one of the first ones was the Skagway to Juneau, because it connected to a railroad, and in the summertime, tourists mainly used it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you could do the highway and do Carcross, et cetera. And that was exciting for the kids as well as Arlene and I. And the VW Bug was just ideal for our small family and the little kids. And we stayed in this old hotel in Carcross, and then we had to get up in the wee hours of the morning, like about 3:30, because we had to, they had to put the car on the flat car in the morning and then be ready for the train to depart around 5 a.m. Mm. And the reason was the train from the south was starting early too, and then we'd meet the train from the south up at the summit at Lake Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think you got off and we had breakfast there. Then we went on to the summit, I guess, from there, and stopped at the summit and waited for the other train to come, where they could have a siding and the two trains could pass. And then we went on down. The reason for doing this in the morning was before the sun would get high enough to threaten avalanches that would come down later in the day on the railroad.
So you were doing this in what time of year?
May. It was fairly early in May, I think.
Yeah, so there would still have been snow up in the high country there.
Yeah. And it was fabulous when we stopped at the summit waiting for the other train. There was alpine tundra with shrub tundra. There was a lot of snow, like 4 feet or so of snow. Mm-hmm. And the male willow ptarmigan were out displaying right there in front of the train on top, walking around in the snow. It was so nice.
Cool.
And the train at that time was mostly all freight cars, with the last one for passengers had a wood stove in it because it could be cool. Mm-hmm. And one conductor would be in that. And you could go out on the back railing of that last car as your train was moving, which was nice when you get in the spectacular places where your mm-hmm. big trestles and beautiful mountains and nice, clear, sunny weather. So it was, that was a nice for all of us. And the kids were small enough that it was so exciting to be on the train, and they could see our little car, on the flat car there being loaded on the train and hitched to the train. And we went.
And at this point, you had your, all three kids?
Two.
Oh, you still just had the two.
Two, yeah. So that, Martin and Peggy Ellen. And so Peggy Ellen was, hadn't been walking for very long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty exciting. So why were you going to Juneau?
At Juneau, then the Department of Fish and Game wanted me to take this position, which was research coordinator for the division, the game division, which later became the Division of Wildlife Conservation, but for the game division, and to be the coordinator and manage this. It was mainly an administrative position in the Juneau office, but I got to travel around to the various research projects under the, that was mainly funded through the Federal Aid in Wildlife Restoration program. So I got to go to places like Kodiak and Afognak, where there are deer study or elk studies going on, and moose studies down in the out of Anchorage areas, and caribou out of Fairbanks, sometimes getting in the field with them. Mm-hmm. In the summertime.
And I guess because Alaska was still such a new state, then it was all very coordinated through Juneau. You didn't have all these separate fish and game offices. And
that position still exists now because it's statewide coordination of the federal aid money. So you have to be close to the central office and a bit close to the legislature. Although we weren't lobbying for this. We just had to provide information on short notice during the legislative session.
But as you say, it was a statewide thing, so it wasn't stationed in Fairbanks and just the Fairbanks district or just the Anchorage district. It was, you had to go everywhere.
At that time, the main administration was out of Juneau, and so there was a central office in Fairbanks and Anchorage, but these were just not different, much different than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
For the field people in the game division. And then there were, the job also included the paperwork and the reports that we had to do, quarterly reports and annual reports, and also, I had to review all these reports and put them together. They were submitted by all of the field biologists and put them together in the final report once a year. And be editor and advisor on if they were writing any papers, technical papers for publication, and there weren't many that were doing that, but there were one or two that were doing that.
So what types of projects were people doing?
Well, it was species-oriented, so there were the biologists that were employed were primarily either working with moose or with caribou or deer or mountain sheep, sometimes more than one species, but the big ones were the moose, caribou, bears, and in southeast deer, yeah, in Prince William Sound, deer, yeah.
Wolves?
There were some work being done on wolves, but there wasn't a big program on studying wolves. There was, when statehood occurred, there was still a bounty on wolves, and then and only about 2 years, and they were still using poison, and the federal government was still doing this, and the state, because of pressure from us young biologists, they Department of Fish and Game went to the legislature with their report to the legislature requesting that the bounty be removed because it was not useful in wildlife management. It was a waste of money, and it was mainly used to some extent as a welfare thing. And so after a couple of years of lobbying the legislature, by us as well as some other groups, there were a few environmental groups getting started. Mm-hmm. The Alaska Conservation Foundation, for example, or Alaska Conservation Society, for example, was one. Then the legislature passed a law making it illegal to use poison to kill wolves and removed the bounty. I think the use of poison came first, and then they removed the bounty on wolves and coyotes and gradually most other creatures that were bounded.
So the type of research that these biologists were doing said it was species-oriented. What were they doing?
Their population dynamics and how you estimate numbers through sometimes aerial surveys, how do you calculate from moose surveys when you're doing track counts in the Yukon Flats relative to the proposed Rampart Dam, for example. Mm-hmm. So you use track counts, and then you would ultimately find the moose. But if it was forested, you couldn't follow the tracks. And so how many did you see versus how many did you miss? And how do you do the studies on that? Well, some of it was groundwork and tracking and working with, with native people. And then another area where there was focus of attention was the studies on whether, well, for example, removal of the wolves, we still didn't know a removal of the wolf bounty when there had been wolf control. We didn't know how that might have affected species like mountain sheep. Were they a main target of the wolves, and were they benefiting from their populations benefiting because they could only hunt the males? Mountain sheep from very early times because they were considered trophies and they wanted the money from bringing trophy hunters in, paying big bucks and hiring guides to hunt them. Same with bears, that we wanted better information on how was the hunting pressure affecting them. And in the case of sheep, or grazing animals, was their habitat overgrazed or not? And then there were beginning studies. There were studies along the Alaska Railroad to reduce the number of moose being killed by the railroad. And some of those were farmed out through the wildlife unit to grad students, a thesis project. Mm-hmm. So, frequently, those led to major changes. One, the first was just to reduce the speed of the trains going through the area around Willow and on the Susitna drainage where most of the moose were being killed, and there were high density of moose. That only partially reduced the numbers killed. So it would give the moose time, and then I think it was the time or day or night also made a difference, so that moose, if the light of the from the train tended to make the moose try to run down the track rather than go off into the woods. And so they tried varying things, working with the railroad on that, and whistles and what have you, slowing the speed going through those areas was a major thing to help. But there were still problems, and it would depend on how deep the snow was and how much food there was. along the railroad that they were moose were feeding on, keeping them close to the railroad. And the Snowmass Railroad became a travel corridor for the moose, which was fine except when the train came. And so then this led to, with bulldozers, making travel corridors for the moose that paralleled the road, parallel to the railroad. So, and there was good, where there was good browse, then the moose would, more of the moose would be there, mm-hmm. where they weren't, they wouldn't be likely killed. And the ones that were just walking down the railroad, were, they had a corridor where they could walk safely to move from one area to another. And that worked fairly well. There were studies getting started in the Anchorage area on the military base where the road went through this good moose habitat on Fort Richardson mainly. And there were a lot of people, and that was the main road to Palmer. Mm-hmm. And there was already a lot of people commuting to work through that area. And so they were already up to about four-lane highway and mm-hmm. people going too fast. And then winter driving, when hard to see the moose if they were there. And they did a lot of experiments that were based on studies done in Scandinavia, mainly Sweden, where they used mirrors first to reflect the headlights into the woods, and that would frighten the moose away from the road. And that had, in Scandinavia, had some significance, positive, and so they worked that there for a while, but still they had problems, and they ended up no surefire method, and the traffic was increasing, and there were, danger to cars and people, injury to people as well as killing moose was getting quite large.
Yeah.
And so then the approach that was taken that they were going to have to fence this section. But then the problem was, how do you keep the moose outside of it? Because you don't, you can't fence the whole base, and you fence the road off. You can't do that because the road has to be open at both ends. Mm. So then they did fencing on both sides of the road, and then they built the type of fencing was big chain link tall fences. When then they had, every so often they would have a fence that went off at an angle that if moose were got onto the roadside, they would try to get back in, and they would go along the fence, and they would get down into pretty soon the squeeze gate where they could force their ways back through, but they couldn't come in from the other side. So it had steel rods that would bend when the moose pushed their way through from one side, but they wouldn't bend.
They couldn't get back.
Couldn't get back. And that was costly, but it was a major improvement in reducing.
So a lot of these studies were pretty baseline scientific research to understand these populations?
Yeah, and then for example, in popular, a lot of the studies were focused on where moose or caribou hunting was taking place. And so the Nelchina Basin and Denali Highway was built early on. Mm-hmm. And so hunting, that was a favorite place for mostly Anchorage people, because they could access it even before the Parks Highway was completed. Mm-hmm. You could get to Cantwell, and I'm sorry, you could get on it from the Richardson Highway.
From Paxson side.
From Paxson. And so there were a lot of studies there on caribou, and some good studies started with building some enclosures to see how what impact caribou were having on the lichen, and so these several small enclosures were, and they had, for those studies, we frequently contracted with some expert on vegetation and soils. There was a fellow, Dr. Henry Hansen from, I think it was Michigan, but I'm not sure, and he came up and worked in the field, and some of the technicians and grad students working on parts of the study were able to work with him in doing soil profiles and seeing how soils affected the relationship of plants, types, and relating to mainly caribou, to a lesser extent, moose. Then there were studies beginning, a lot of increased use of aircraft for counting, and then getting into use of radio collars to answer questions on mortality and ultimately calf mortality. But that came after I was back at the wildlife unit, most of that. But there were intensive aerial survey work being done on and some groundwork being done on counting caribou, getting Section 8 composition counts. And for moose, there was a lot of focus on moose on the Kenai, and there was some joint collaboration, very good collaboration between the federal government. The Kenai Refuge at that time was called a moose range, National Moose Range, and state biologists, the first state biologists working down there on the Kenai outside of the refuge. But they started a moose research center there. And that was started actually by the federal government and gradually the Department of, on the refuge, and with big 1 square mile enclosures. So they could put given numbers of moose in each one, and they could also do tame moose and have paddocks where they could do feeding trials with moose and seeing what kind of forage was appropriate and digestibility. Much of that, that was some of the leading work of that kind before the university got into it, that kind of work.
Interesting.
And then in southeast, there was as glaciers were receding gradually there, and there Juneau with in Berners Bay, where the glacier there was pulling back, and the new vegetation was ideal moose browse. There was young birch and willow and cottonwood mainly. And so the plan was to capture moose calves, raise them for a while in captivity, then release them out there and start a moose population, which they did. There was also attempts to transplant mountain goats to the Kodiak Island. And those ultimately resulted in a population of mountain goats being established on Kodiak.
So it was a successful transplant?
Yeah, to a limited extent because it's limited habitat. But it's they have hunting seasons and they're quite visible at times from the roads or from aircraft.
Well, it sounds like from that job you really got a great overview and understanding of all what was going on around the whole state.
Yeah, definitely. That was good in that regard, and it was good training for me, for sure, and for whether I stayed it with Fish and Game. In fact, Jim Brooks, who was head of that time of the Game Division, and later became Commissioner of Fish and Game, but he foresaw, he had lived in the bush on the Seward Peninsula, and he was a pilot. And before he went to, before he came back to the university and did a master's degree at the university, and he married a native woman who was also a student, who came and became a student at the university. And well, he was pretty concerned and sensitive, and he'd done work with marine mammal work in Bristol Bay and Prince William Sound just before statehood with the state, the then Department of Fisheries. So he had a good understanding of native interests, which were sort of ignored in the old territorial days before statehood. Natives were, you know, they kind of do their thing, and we don't, and the management was focused on the non-native population, the hunters and the guided hunters. And the same was true to a large extent on the fisheries, sport fisheries work. So Jim Brooks was thinking ahead, and he was looking for me to be, after some training, that position in Juneau. And he knew I didn't want to stay in that administrative, that particular administrative position all the time, but I was willing to look at other options. And he suggested that I would be, he was going to lobby the legislature to start a subsistence division and wanted me to head that up. And that was the kind of challenge I kind of liked, because I had enough, I learned enough about Alaska Natives as a student here at University of Alaska, and had always had a keen interest in then working in Southeast Alaska. Yeah, I went to Native villages occasionally to do assessment of harvests by the Native people of deer, and I certainly had a concern that their interests were important and should be considered in management, mm-hmm. rather than just ignoring them.
So do you know why Jim hired you for that research oversight job in the first place?
Yeah, because that was the understanding when I when statehood came and I transferred to Department of Fish and Game, the understanding was I would at first spend the summers finishing up my own fieldwork for my doctoral research, and I would remain an employee of Fish and Wildlife, or Fish and Game then, because I had transferred to them. But ultimately, I would want a job with Fish and Game. And so, but I was also working on the PhD, so my qualifications for positions would change somewhat. But the general understanding was, yeah, they would have a position for me that would be appropriate.
So they kind of kept a position or kept one in mind for when you were...
Probably didn't have a specific one in mind, but at the time when I finally finished up, that was one that they needed someone for. And they figured I could handle it, and it was okay. It fit my plans mm-hmm. pretty well.
Well, let's step back a second. When there was the transition from a territory where it was Fish and Wildlife Service being in charge, and then statehood and Fish and Game became the institution that took over this. You know, some people transferred, some people lost their jobs. How did that all work?
Well, it obviously that was a major transition. It and it worked surprisingly well. There were people like that lost, a lot of people were going to lose their Fish and Wildlife positions because the Fish and Wildlife Service was no longer being responsible, and so the Fish and Wildlife Service had some responsibility to employees like myself, and so they put their employees in Alaska on a special category for any jobs that opened up nationally with wildlife, mostly with wildlife refuges or waterfowl management, migratory bird management, those kind of jobs scattered throughout the entire United States. If it was an opening, a refuge manager or assistant refuge manager or refuge biologist would open up. There weren't that many jobs, but we all got the notice first before they opened it up to the general public to advertise it. And so it would be simply a transfer. And so that was an option we had, but there wasn't a lot to choose from.
And probably many people wanted to stay in Alaska.
Yeah, several did, like myself. And Will Troyer, for example, he was in the same boat. And Jim King. And so Jim had started to work for the state as a game warden. And so Will had, he was working for the territory as a game warden at first in Juneau, and maybe as a technician, stream guarders. But he had also, you know, established a good reputation, and he was trained as a biologist. Mm-hmm. He had a master's degree from, I think it was the University of Montana at Missoula. And he ultimately wanted to get into wildlife research and management. And so they offered him a position as a refuge, one of the refuges.
So the Fish and Wildlife Service retained a few jobs in Alaska.
Yeah.
So a few people who started with Fish and Wildlife were able to stay Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, that's true. Because, yeah, some of them retired and or moved outside the state. There was a reasonable turnover. And so there were a few people like Will Troyer that was able to stay with the federal government, but under statehood, whereas he had been with the federal government like me, I was under territory.
And so you ended up switching to Fish and Game. Was that your choice?
Yeah, it was, because I definitely wanted to stay in Alaska, and at that moment, I had experience in Southeast, so I had to give up my position with the deer to be gone for two academic years in the PhD, but I wanted to stay affiliated with Southeast because I would be coming back in two summers to finish up my research as a Fish and Game employee for a PhD dissertation. Right. But then when I finished my residency requirement at UBC, then Brooks understood that I would be looking for a job.
Right.
Because then the financing was very important. Because
right. You had a family.
Didn't have any funding during the academic year, and the amount of support I got from the university was minuscule. But it was helpful as a teaching assistant and those kind of things.
And you had a family. Was your wife able to work? Or?
Well, the kids were so small that she wasn't able to work. Mm-hmm. So she couldn't take a job because she'd have to have someone come in and take care of the kids, right. And it wouldn't be possible. She was trained as a teacher.
Okay.
And so later on, she could take jobs as substitute teachers and when the kids got big enough.
Right.
So
this job in Juneau that you went to, you weren't out in the field doing your own biological research anymore.
That's correct.
How did that sit
with you? In the long run, obviously, it wouldn't have been very satisfying to me. But my evenings were spent writing for the thesis up.
Oh, you were still writing up the thesis?
Yeah, I hadn't finished writing the thesis. And so I would spend evenings, and I, you know, it was like I couldn't do these things in the office during the day because I had other things on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And Brooks had, you know, made that clear when I came. I said, you know, I got to write this thesis. And he said, well, there might be times, but you've got a job to do for us, and it's an important one. And so I don't think it's going to work out.
Especially,
but he took some of the pressure off me by creating an assistant position who was more like a clerk secretary, but she was a biologist that had, she was doing some of the work. She was looking for a job because women were having a hard time getting jobs if they were trained in wildlife. She had some training, had training in wildlife, and so Emily, and so we hired her, and she took some of the pressure off my shoulders in terms of report writing. I'd rough things out, and she would put the reports together, but sometimes taking over quite a bit of that. Mm-hmm. So, because technically I should be spending a lot of my time traveling throughout the state as well as in the office, but obviously I didn't want to travel too much because I had a family at home. Mm-hmm. And I had the writing to do. I couldn't do that if I was traveling around.
But you had to travel to some extent.
Yep. And frankly, I mean, I liked traveling and I liked keeping in touch. It was just the right balance. And in the summer times, as it was the case when I was full-time in Petersburg with the deer work, it was the summer was not working with deer usually. It was moving up to Anchorage and working, say, out of Anchorage for mountain sheep counts, for banding geese in the Copper River Delta. And I would get assigned to go out there, hire an assistant, and who had a boat with an outboard. He fished, but he was willing to do this, and we had a cabin. We stayed out, and we'd be out there for about 2 weeks, and that was before the earthquake, mm-hmm. so there was a lot of goose habitat, a lot of geese. These are the big, largest Canada geese, and at high tide, these sloughs would be full of water and just starting to flood into the intertidal wetlands where the geese would be grazing. And the adults and young, when they were out there, when the young were already big enough that you could band them, they were about two-thirds size of the adults, and then the adults would be undergoing regrowing their flight feathers, so mm-hmm. they couldn't fly at that time.
So you banded them when they were molting?
Yep. So we would, and we did it the old-fashioned way with the two of us. He ran the outboard. I stood up on the platform in front with a rope, and so I could see over the edge of the sedge when the tide was in, and a geese grazing there would hear the boat coming, but they would pop their heads up if they were out there and then pull them down quickly. And so if you saw these heads, I would give the signal to head for the shore, and I'd try to keep an eye on where I saw those geese heads. And when we got ashore, my job was to throw the anchor out onto the mud and so the boat didn't drift away. And the two of us took off with big salmon landing nets and hip boots, running as fast as we could and to this spot. And usually, if we were lucky, they hadn't moved very far. And then when we got close, they would start running. And they aggregated after the young were born. So you'd have two or three broods together. So you might have 25 or 30 geese there. And we'd go and try to catch as many as we could in one first chance, because they scattered and hid when, and if they got in the water, they would get across wider slough, and you couldn't get to them without going back and getting the boat.
And they couldn't fly away from you because they were molting.
Yeah, that they could run like mad, and they could hide. And so if we're lucky, each of us could get about 3 or 4 geese. That was as much as we could carry in our nets. And then we would, we usually had around our neck the bands on a wire and the banding wire. And so we would then come together and band these geese, and we could put hobble them, the adults, but mostly we could cover them with a big tarp or something so that they wouldn't run away from us, and gradually band them and release them and get other information on them.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you weigh and measure them?
No, we identified whether they're young and adults and made, you know, just general comments on their size and whether they were starting, young when were starting to grow their feathers, and especially their flight feathers, because they, all of them would be gaining flight close to the same time. Then we would release them, and then we'd go back and try again. But we'd only have a short time when the tide was high. If we waited too long, we couldn't get back to the cabin to sleep and eat. And so the important thing was to get back in cabin before the water disappeared. And if we did, then we cooked up food and slept. So we didn't bring any of that stuff with us. We just took rain gear and our hip boots and other things. We might have had an apple or an orange, but that was about it.
And so this, you were doing this during the summers while you were in graduate school?
No, this was when I was, I did those in the summers when I was a deer biologist too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it was before.
But it was only a couple of week period. So the other times I was up in the mountains counting mountain sheep, on the Kenai, the Chugach Mountains, the Talkeetnas, the Alaska Range, and the White Mountains.
So that's when you were based out of Petersburg?
That was my home base where my wife and kids were.
Right.
Yep.
So you were doing the deer work, and then you did this bird stuff and all that. So I'm just trying to get the time period. It's when you were still living in Petersburg. They sent you other places.
I would be gone for about a month and a half.
They sent you all these other places.
To do these other things, right, and then come back. And then there were some summer things I could do when I was down there, of course, for the hunting season, which started in August. Mm-hmm. So I had some summer, and that was good because then I could get out with the family and good weather and picnic and boat around.
Mm-hmm. So this bird banding, did you always work with the same other person?
Yeah.
And who was that?
Bob Bellos. He was a drift net fisherman, but he was like in his early 20s. He was a very competent guy.
So he wasn't another Fish and Wildlife Service biologist?
No, it just turned out that he was available, and he worked as a, he was paid as a technician, and but then he made better, once the fish started running later on, then he went, he was full-time commercial fisherman.
Right.
Living in Cordova.
So this was all based out of Cordova.
For the banding, yeah.
Yeah.
And we had a target of, if we could get 400 geese banded, that was good. If we could get over 200, that was good too. But if we got to 400, we closed up shop because we wanted to have adequate sample banded. And we were under supervision of the waterfowl flyway biologist, Henry Hansen. He was based out of Juneau, and he was doing work all over the state and would come out and visit us occasionally while we were doing this work. But it was sort of up to us to figure out ways to be most productive in catching because you could be a total failure if through a tide, and because you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, or you got a poor start, or the weather was terrible. There were a lot of reasons why you didn't get 4 or 5 geese banded per day.
Mm-hmm. So how did you figure all that out? Had somebody done it before you guys and told you?
Yeah, but they actually later decided it was more efficient to hire a big crew and set up nets and do a drive. So there was more money involved and more labor, but it was concentrated in, you could be, 1 week could do it, usually. But you also had air support and things like that that we didn't have.
So did you get your 400 geese a season?
I'm not sure whether it's 400. We had a target. It might have been less than that. We mostly did, yeah. And I only did this 2 summers. But it was exciting, too. Occasionally, we'd get a chance to tag a couple of swans. Hmm. And there was a lot of diversity, and a lot of diversity in bird life there and other life that we saw.
Well, I say it sounds somewhat, challenging, the figuring out, what's the best way to do this? Let's try this. Oh, no, that didn't work. Let's adjust that. I mean, that must be kind of fun.
Yeah, some of those were successful. Like we found, if we went way out on the, of course, the edge of the sea on the delta, there's these mud flats. And some of those, the geese might be going out on the mud flats. And some of the mud flats, you could run down the geese in. Some of them you couldn't because the mud was too sinky and the geese didn't sink as far as we did. There were a lot of potential problems, and a couple of times we really got in that mud situation. We wanted to get out badly, and we had problems. We had to get the boat back into the main drainage channel because you didn't see it before the tide went out. And the tide comes and goes fast there because it's a big tide and it's very gradual. So you can have plenty of water for the boat, and then half an hour later, there's not. Mm-hmm. And we did have one time, I remember, when we were going up a slough and these geese were there and right on the bank. No, they're in the slough swimming. Two or three broods. And when they came around the bend, there they were, and they kind of split up, and the majority went on one shore. And so I shouted to Bob, "Let's go to shore there." And so he ran ashore, and he ran ashore and dropped me off, but then he decided to just push the boat over to the other side. There was a fairly narrow channel, and go after the geese on the other side. Well, I was pretty successful in catching geese and came back to the boat, and the boat was on the other side. And he felt bad about this. He hadn't got any of the geese. And then when he tried to get the boat off, the tide was dropping, and the boat was stuck. And so he said, "I think I can get it off, And I said, "Well, take the motor off to lighten the weight." And he said, "No, I can get it." But all the times the water is disappearing, and it's mud, the boat is stuck in this mud. It's sort of, a suction holds a flat bottom boat. It was a plywood boat. And it was too late. He couldn't get the motor off it wouldn't get out. So here he's stuck on one side. I had to let my geese go because he had the bands in the boat. And he didn't have any geese, and I had geese. And so, it was pretty good weather. So my rain gear was there. I just in a t-shirt. and the boots and trousers in, and which was plenty warm when you're running around in your boots. And so here we had, like, it was too late. I mean, I would have swam across the slough if it was earlier, but by that time, the two of us couldn't get it off, and there wasn't enough water left in the slough. So and it was deep enough, so I couldn't just wade across. And so we had to stay and just wait for like 5 hours or 6 hours for the tide to come back. And that was not the greatest, because I had to literally keep walking to keep warm.
Wow.
Which was okay, but eventually you get tired of walking.
Right.
Of course, we were hungry. When the tide came back and he got over, he was pretty humble, but those things happened, and we went back to the cabin and had a big meal and went to bed and slept for a long time.
And you guys continued to be on good terms and work well together. So.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And then when our supervisor came, he flew in on a float plane, and he stayed with us for a couple of days. And, of course, he wanted to go out with us, and we wanted him to do that. And it was kind of windy, and when we got up the next morning, but we told him, we got to get going. We got to take advantage of this tide. And didn't want to rush through breakfast. We cooked up pancakes or something. We said, let's get going, or we're going to have a problem, and we won't have any time. So then we got off to a good start. And so, you know, the standard was that Bob would run the motor and I would be standing on this seat with my legs spread apart, holding on to the rope from the bow, the anchor rope, and so I could have good balance and control. And sometimes if you turned the motor around a sharp bend, the boat would kind of start sliding, and if you leaned in that direction, it would catch and it'd come to a stop quick, so you had to brace yourself for that. Well, when Hank came, he wanted to be up there with me, the two of us, so we couldn't spread our legs far enough apart, and we shared the rope, holding the rope. And about the first time around a bend, I said, Hank, you got to be careful. Let's brace yourself. And they started slipping, and then it caught, and he just went right overboard. And so with all of his clothes on and everything. So we loaded him back in, and we went back to the cabin, took his clothes off and got dry clothes on and warmed up. And so it was too late to get out now. So we waited for the next one, and we went out the next one with him. And that was in the evening, and we did pretty well. And but at full tide, it's very deceptive, because there's little sloughs, little drainage ditches. At full tide, you can't see them, because the grass, the sedge, is long, and it floats up, and it all looks like continuous. And I said, you got to watch, though. There's some of those. So when you come to them, you got to learn like that. They're only about, you know, 2 feet wide, but they're sloping banks. So you got to know when to jump, so you land on the bank on the other side, not in the middle. So we took off after some geese, and there were a lot of geese, and we went in different directions. And he was running. He was a big guy. He was doing very well and heading right for these geese. And suddenly he just disappeared, because he didn't even see this slough.
Uh-oh.
And he went right down, total immersion. So again, he stuck it out for the rest of the high tide. And then we went back and had to get dried again.
Poor guy.
Poor guy. But he did have rain gear, so going back, it wasn't too bad.
And you never had that problem? You never fell in?
No, I never fell in. We fell down sometimes in the Viet mud.
Yeah.
It got a little muddy, but never total immersion.
Well, running in hip boots in mud and tall grass can't be easy.
It isn't easy. I mean, obviously, we're in good shape by the end of that time. And we had to be in reasonable shape to start. Yeah, that wasn't easy, but I didn't think too much of it. You had to have the boots on.
Wow.
It probably would have been better to use a wetsuit, but they didn't have those, you know, for the bottom.
Yeah.
And the same on your feet.
Or like chest waders or something? Those neoprene things?
No, those wet foam deals you can put on, and they just slide them on in there.
Oh, right. Wetsuit, yeah.
Yeah, and they're good on even on gravel, but there we didn't, footing wasn't so much of a problem because it was usually mud or sound sedge bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty good running. It wasn't tussocky sedges. It was once you get up when on higher, drier ground, it was good running.
So how come you sat up in front like that in the boat?
I stood up.
Oh, you were standing up?
Standing up.
Oh.
So we could see, because when the tide was going on, you had to be up high to see over this grass sedge and see the geese. Otherwise, okay. You didn't know where the geese were, unless you saw them in the slough, which was not regularly the case.
And so you were holding onto the rope as your balance thing, okay.
Yeah, you leaned back against the rope. So if you came to, you had some leeway if you came to a stop quickly, but you knew what was going because you were watching the river and everything, and there was no gravel bars and snags there. If there was, you could see it well in advance, and Bob would slow down.
And you weren't blocking Bob's view? He could still see where he was going?
Pardon?
By you standing up there in front, you weren't blocking his view driving?
No, because he saw the banks, and he was turning as a slough turn, and I was looking over the banks. So had visibility, even if it was only through my legs and, and around the side.
Well, I didn't realize that when you were doing the deer biology job down in Petersburg, you were off doing this other
sometimes
stuff.
Assigned to do other things, yeah.
Yeah. What other ones? You mentioned some other ones.
Well, other things I had to do was mainly those up there. Well, one of them was this one summer, I went to St. Matthew Island for the first time.
Oh, that was
1957.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, then my advisor then was in Anchorage, was Bob Scott, the same guy who had been my advisor for the sheep work.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd worked for him a lot, and also when I was a grad student. And I was still working for him when I'd go up there to Anchorage and work to the mountain sheep studies. And so he said they had this potential study and wanted to know if I would be interested in doing it. He said he thought I was the best person to do it. And so this was the St. Matthew Island where the Fish and Wildlife Director, who was a great pilot, and Clarence Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
Had flown a twin-engine plane out there when they were doing some work in the Aleutians, or the Pribilofs. They flew out over St. Matthew and had good weather, which is unusual, but they had good weather, and they knew that their reindeer had been introduced by the Coast Guard, and there had been Robert Rouse, a parasitologist, and his wife had been out there in 1954 and camped, they got a Coast Guard guide ride out there, and they camped on a driftwood, in a driftwood hut that they built. And they were studying parasites in the endemic vole species that was there, Microtus abbreviatus, called a singing vole. And they were also doing the same work with the Arctic foxes, looking for the parasites that they carried. But he was a combination parasitologist and mammalogist, so he was collecting specimens for mammalogical studies, including some of the early first genetic work with chromosomes to try to determine whether the voles were endemic, a true endemic species. So at any rate, they had reported that the reindeer were obviously increasing. They could see the impact on the lichens, the winter range, and they saw some scattered around the landscape where they were camped. And they didn't make an effort to do a count, but there were like hundreds, a few hundreds at least. And so then that's when Clarence, the year later, I think, in the summer, Clarence Rode flew out there with someone else with him, and they had good weather, and they were able to do a rough count with a twin engine plane going pretty fast, not the best, but it's open tundra and hilly country, and they, I think it was, they estimated about 1,500 reindeer. And so that was then led to the stimulation for a study, because then the question was raised. They knew that the reindeer had been introduced by the Coast Guard during the Second World War, when they had a men stationed there at a Loran navigational station. And there had also been a Army weather station there right at the beginning, before the land station was there during the Second World War. And so it was nip and tuck that whether they might be cut off by the Japanese, and they might even be invaded. But so they needed, the Coast Guard thought it would be a good idea to release reindeer. So they got the Coast Guard boat, picked up reindeer, 24 reindeer from Nunavak Island, I think 20 females and 5 males, and one male was drowned when they were unloading. So then they went back to St. Matthew and unloaded them, and they onto the island, and they established these. But then it was only, that was in 1944, and then, I think it was 1944, yeah. And then, of course, the war was over in late 1945 in the Pacific. And so the Coast Guard pulled out, shut down the station, but the reindeer were left there, where there were no natural predators and no people living, and no harbors or airports, and hard to get there. And so when the Fish and Wildlife Service, technically they were responsible, and this is a, St. Matthew Islands were a biological reserve that would have been established by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1909, the first such reserve in Alaska and the U.S., I think.
I didn't know that. That St. Matthew Island was a biological reserve that
it was
long ago.
It was called the Bering Sea Reserve, I think, something like that. Yep. And mainly because of the literally over a million birds, primarily seabirds, but also ground nesting birds, that nested on the island every year. And so they didn't know much about it, but they knew a little bit from Coast Guard and early and Rausch's work. So then they had to make a decision as what about these animals there? I mean, there's going to be a population problem eventually, and what impact are they going to have on the vegetation And are they going to have a problem, impact on ground nesting birds? Well, all of these were probably possibilities, likely possibilities, but no one knew how many deer was the limit for population, and winter food would probably be the limiting factor because it was lush green tundra in the summer. There wasn't a shortage, but there wasn't. The lichens were not as uniformly distributed over the island. There were some areas where there, the southern end, where there were a lot of lichens, and other areas, not so many, or none, on Rocky Mountains. And so then Bob Scott was asked to try to design a project, and then who to be involved in doing it. So they figured that I would be a good possibility to go out there and with an assistant and spend 2 or 3 weeks on the island, do a count, do some initial vegetation work, build some exclosures. Mm-hmm. And so that he asked me if I would be willing to do that. Well, that I was working out of Anchorage, and my wife and children were in Petersburg, so it wasn't any longer away from home, but it was maybe a little longer because it was an add-on to the other things I was doing. But it sounded to me like a wonderful challenge and a study. And I like those kind of things where I was given the responsibility to organize the whole thing. And yeah, I had some help in the initial design of what we should be doing out there from Bob Scott. But once I got out there, I was on my own to follow through and decide on where my priorities should be. Counting the animals was one, but also doing vegetation reconnaissance and doing some quantitative measurements as well as building exclosures, plus exploring the island. So then Scott had, I think he was working in out of Fairbanks at that time, and he knew of a undergraduate student who was in wildlife that he thought would be available as a field assistant, and that turned out to be Jim Wisenhant. And Jim was recruited, and so the two of us and Scott made the arrangements with the Coast Guard to get us out there. So we had to organize a lot of the gear, but I was able to just give them the list of things, and especially for the exclosures, so that they could get everything organized in Anchorage, and it'd all be there in Anchorage. And then we had to get flown down to, I think commercially, to Kodiak, where we'd meet this Coast Guard boat, which was a training ship, a big training ship with a big, there were over 100 crew members on because they were training purposes, and that was the Wachusett was the name of it. And so we got aboard there, and then we cruised along the southern Alaska Peninsula up through the first pass into the Bering Sea. But as we were still in the Pacific, the big storm came up, and it was pretty rough going. And it was amusing in retrospect, and not too, it was a little bit amusing while we were there, but both Jim and I were not seasick at all. And they assigned us, they said, unfortunately, all of the bunks are full for the crew, but we have, there's two bunks up in this weather observation place where it was about like a small garage with a garage door on it where they released weather balloons. And so you had to climb up through the superstructure of the ship. So you're way up there above the deck.
So you were really going
exactly.
side to side in those rough seas.
And the worst case, we just had to lock our... Fortunately, the bunks, one over the other, had a steel bar that you could get your knee under and keep you from rolling out. But you couldn't sleep during the storm. And there was inside of one of these cabinets, a file cabinet, there was something rolling back and forth all the time. Later, we learned it was a glass ball that one of them had picked up on the beach somewhere, put it in there. It was like bang, 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 bang. And I remember finally when we got through the pass and got into the Bering Sea, the storm was over and we went down to our breakfast, Jim and I did, and there was only one, and we were able to eat with the officers. The only officer that came for breakfast, the rest of them were sick. Was a red-haired young guy, lieutenant, really nice guy. And so we sat there eating our oatmeal and whatever we had for breakfast, and we didn't have any problems. The boat was still rocking a bit, but not too bad. So then we had more excitement because then word came over the radio that there was a fishing boat missing from Dillingham out there. It was out there in the storm, and it's missing. And they lost radio contact, et cetera, et cetera. And they had to search because we were right heading through that area. So and it was foggy then. So after only a couple hours in the search, they spotted with the radar or something, and it turned out to be the fishing boat. Still in the water, and no sign of life. And so we pulled up, and they lowered a Zodiac, I think, and or a boat. That was a regular lifeboat, and a few crew members motored over to it, and they had a little walkie-talkies, and this is, we don't see anybody, no sign, and then when they got aboard, there's two people here, and they seem to be alive. And then they didn't tell us, and it was kind of a cryptic conversation relayed from the radio man who had to tell the captain first. But these guys had engine problem, and in the storm. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get the engine going. And so they figured they had quite a bit of liquor aboard. They had a big party. They figured if they're not going to make it through the storm, at least they should have a good time. So they were all drunk. These two guys were drunk. And so they had to bring... They questioned whether one of them could even get on. They'd have to use a stretcher. But it turned out they were able to load the two in the boat and come back, and they took these guys in the sick bay. And they recovered eventually. But that delayed us because we had to wait until another boat was able to come to tow this boat back in and pick up these two guys. And they were well enough that several hours later, the other boat showed up and they offloaded them and they towed the other boat in. And then we continued on and got dropped off at St. Matthew. And all of our gear, and it was pretty, there were some new things we had. They had made up, they didn't have fancy radios like they have now. So, but yet, this aircraft division, they were good with radios and aircraft, and so they rigged up, built a box that was like a small bookcase, and in it was this tube kind of radio, and that they designed specially and tested it, and then they had this big antenna that we had to reel out and make, get driftwood to make poles to hang it in certain directions. They tested it and had to be, had to string this antenna in certain directions, and we wanted to be able to reach both the Coast Guard boat, but more importantly, the radio station at the refuge at Bethel, the wildlife refuge at Bethel, which had people standing by on the radio most of the time, somebody, and so we could have a radio schedule with them to tell them that we were okay on a daily, or every couple of days or something. We had to have a generator, and they had a car battery and a generator and gasoline for the generator just for this radio, because it took a lot of juice. And but it, as a result of it, when we had an extra wire extension cord, we could have this generator outside of this driftwood hut that Rausch had built, and we'd have the generator outside. When we turned it on to charge the battery, we'd do that at night when it had getting dark, and when we had the extension cord and one light bulb, we could have some light while we were charging the battery. And well, we also had a Coleman lantern for inside. This driftwood hut didn't have any windows, so you had to have some light. And well, that worked out well. And we, the only way you could get around was walking, and we were both in good shape, and we walked, and we had a small tent, and we did the whole island, set up a bunch of line transects through different vegetation types, and we recorded the information on the vegetation, and then we built, we selected places to build three enclosures within.
Exclosures or enclosures?
Those enclosed vegetation plots, and they excluded the reindeer. And so we built two of them within walking distance, a close walking distance from we actually were able to get the wire and post for one of them dropped off further south by the Coast Guard before they dropped us ashore, and then they offloaded this, and this was heavy stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot to carry.
So, it took us two of us to carry the roll of wire for the across the tundra to the locations, and we did that. And one of them was up on a little bench, but we got them up there and built the enclosures, and did a nice job under the circumstances. Did it. Laid out the vegetative cordrats and tried not to damage those while we were building. There were 4 meter square cordrats, 2 within the enclosure and 2 outside. So the enclosures were approximately 10 by 10 feet. And so we got these 3 enclosures up in different vegetation types that had been used by the reindeer and had reasonable amounts of lichens in them. And then, but we had to, you know, guide these things well because it's so windy there. And so we had stakes to drive in, metal stakes, especially for fencing, and stout wire, and guide all 4 corners. And so they were really quite secure. And then we covered the whole island systematically, counting the reindeer as we moved from mountain ridge to mountain ridge, and looking over broad areas of the lowlands, and moving north. And we found that most of the reindeer were in the south, where we're close to our camp, where on the other side of the island, where the Lawrence station was, and where, in retrospect, that's where most of the lichens were. for Winter Forge.
Was by your hut where the reindeer were?
In the southern portion of the southern one-third of the island. As we went north, it was very interesting because, you know, there's lakes and that are frequently dammed by the beach. Gravel would have char in them. Hmm. And one of the things we did was collected some char from, we ate quite a bit of char. We had a small gill net, and we were camped near the big lake, the largest lake on the island. And we could get nice char that were, 20 inches or more long. Really wonderful eating. And we had a permit to take 10 reindeer to get body composition measurements and collect other information from them, age, sex, and general condition, look for parasites and on the 10 reindeer. And, of course, we ate a lot of reindeer. But we had to be careful with the reindeer because there were a lot of red fox, Arctic foxes there, and they were real scroungers, and you couldn't put any food out unless you hung it from a pole hanging from the roof of the cabin that they couldn't get to, and which we did. And things kept well in the cool, moist, windy air. There weren't flies normally to bother us unless it got calm. And so we ate well, fish, and but when we hiked, we had to have lighter food, and so we'd have to have, we had a small tent and a two-person tent with, I think we had a little gas stove,
the too. The Primus stove or something?
A tiny one, because we preferred to use driftwood if we were camped on the beach, but there wasn't driftwood on every beach, and there were no trees on the island.
Right.
So wood was, some places there was a great abundance of driftwood, and some places none, depending on the side of the island you happen to be on. And we didn't have any knowledge of the island, really, until we hiked it. And that was just fascinating because we were interested in seeing the bird concentrations and seeing as much as we could and explore the island and finding where we'd find unique vegetation types. We would stop and with a line big tape and lay out a transect and put a small cairn at one end and the other and record at point intervals along the tape of vegetation that was here by species. So we sometimes had to collect plants to identify them, whereas mostly I could identify the plants and tell which ones were dominant in the given area.
Mm-hmm. And so how long were you out there?
About 3 weeks.
Oh. And what time of year?
This was in, I think, July into August. Probably mid-July to early August, something like that. And then the Coast Guard boat picked us up again. Yeah. And took us back to Dutch Harbor, I think, and then we had to fly commercially from there. But they were always good about getting us ashore and picking us up, even though early on they used these lifeboats that had an inboard motor, and so they could handle surf pretty well, but you had to, if there wasn't too much wave action, you could do it with hip boots on without getting too wet. If it was a little rough, then somebody had to get wet. Those boats, they'd have about four crew, so a couple of them could be holding the boat, and then we had these heavy things like that radio
Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of supplies to offload. It wasn't just you jumping out.
No, and they were mostly in waterproof containers. And so they were good about offloading the stuff above the wave action and where we could back it then.
So they weren't using Zodiacs at that point?
No.
So they were wooden, kind of like a dory, a high-sided?
They were lifeboats.
Yeah, okay, so kind of high-sided wooden boats.
Yeah, and they did have some of them had inboard motors that they could use. Others just oars and sail if they were used as lifeboats.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have a capacity for about 30 people probably in one of them.
Oh, okay, that's pretty big.
25 or 30.
So you could get all your gear and you in one boat and one load?
I think so, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So that was the beginning. And then I wrote up a long report on that included all this, birds seen and bird species seen and the what it was like, what buildings were of evidence that people had been there before, including mm-hmm. there had been some fox trappers there in the 20s, I think, and overwintering. And I found old remains of a couple of Russian structures as well as, and we did get ashore when we were being, just before they dropped us off, we did a, they dropped me on Hall Island, and I could get ashore where their reindeer hadn't got to it. And that's an island only about 3.5 miles from north of St. Matthew, where the reindeer never got to. And so it had vegetation types similar to on St. Matthew with good lichens. So I could make comparisons there between the lichens versus the ones on St. Matthew.
What was the name of that again?
Hall, H-A-L-L.
Okay.
So it's one of the three islands in the St. Matthew group. St. Matthew is the big one, and then there's like 32 miles long by averaging about 3.5 miles wide. And then one smaller rocky island toward the south end of St. Matthew, about 9 miles from St. Matthew, called Pinnacle, very steep-sided but loaded with seabirds.
Hmm. So was this study successful then? Or what was the outcome of your study?
Well, it was like a reconnaissance study, but also beginning of a longer-range study to monitor the reindeer. But that wasn't when I did this. There was no knowing when the next time anybody would get out there, but I did the preliminary thing and wrote up, and it was published in a wildlife, Fish and Wildlife series publication about the St. Matthew Island and the reindeer.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the beginning, the baseline information. Vegetation. It was very detailed with the vegetation and photos, a lot of black and white photos of the vegetation plots and things like that. So it was baseline studies upon which further was. But then I got out there, it ended up I did all of the follow-up studies. But so when I was, that was that study. Then the next time I went out, I was a wildlife unit leader at the university in 1963. Again, the Coast Guard, different Coast Guard boat, boy tender, I guess it was, took us out and picked us up, and we did the counts. 63 was, yeah. There was a big team went out that time because people wanted to do more. There was one of the stomach contents of a char that we caught in the lake, or maybe Rouse caught it, was there wasn't char tissue, and there were some sticklebacks in the other lake, but it was assumed that there were just Arctic char there in the sticklebacks. But they found this muscle tissue of another fish and couldn't identify it, and they sent it to University of British Columbia fisheries guy, and he identified it as blackfish, which is unique because blackfish is a freshwater fish. It's not it isn't able to live in salt water.
Whereas so char go in both, right?
Yeah. And char can readily get in to these lakes from the sea when the lakes are full and running out over the gravel. They can get in that way. And sometimes there's an open channel that's for a couple of years between big lakes and or eight lakes. And but once they're in there, like in the big lake, there was no outlet to the sea left, but there, because they're all beach ridges had closed it off. And but there are lots of char, and they're breeding successfully, and you could get some with fishing tackle as well as with a gill net. And but we never, in 57, we never saw any sign of other fish. We did see some sticklebacks, but just char. So it turned out to be blackfish, and so the blackfish would be relics from when St. Matthew was part of the Beringia, when the sea levels were lowered some 10 plus thousand years ago, and it was, the St. Matthew then would be part of the coastal shelf and the mainland of Alaska, along with the Pribilof Islands. So this is of interest, and obviously that vole had to get there under those conditions too, whereas Arctic foxes could get there on the sea ice, and birds by wing. So so then in 63, then it became my project. Scott was no longer, he was retired, I think. He was in Washington. He transferred to Washington and was head of refuges. And so I, it was up to me to follow through. And I made the connections with the Coast Guard, and then I connections with people. I got to know some of these fisher people at UBC, and so they, one of the grad students who was in the fisheries program came along to collect blackfish, and he had some rotenone, which can be put into little streams, and knocks the fish out, and it's just temporary, and it's biodegradable. And so they were prepared to that. They were prepared to do some fishing for in the sea too. They had a little inflatable raft, and they could let out on a line, and then try to fish for crab and anything else that they could get. And so then there was also a person from the Bureau of Indian Affairs who volunteered to come out and help with the counting and work. And then Dr. Francis Fay volunteered to come out and wanted to come out to collect more foxes and voles for Dr. Rouse's work. He had collected some of the voles alive and started a colony at the university in Fairbanks. And he wanted, it was a small colony, he wanted to get some more. And Francis Fay, Bud Fay, was mainly charged with trapping some life-trapping some, and to bring back.
So Bud Fay, Francis was his given name. Bud says, okay, I've heard the name Bud Fay.
Yeah. And so he, yeah, and he had originally, his PhD was from UBC and on Walrus in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So then we all went out, and...
Do you remember the name of the grad student or the BIA person?
I can I can get it. It was the son of my major professor when I was a PhD student down there. Cowan was his last name.
Was the grad
Gary,
student?
Gary, I think.
Was the grad student?
Gary Cowan, yeah. He was in fisheries.
Erie?
Pardon?
His first name was what?
Gary.
Oh, Gary.
I think it was Gary Cowan, but I can check on that.
Anyway.
And there may have been, he might have had another person with him to do the fishery stuff. But I don't know, I'll have to check on that too. And so then we got out there, and we had a permit again to take, ten, maybe more than 10 reindeer. And we figured there would be lots of them. And we got there, and there were lots of them. I mean, there were reindeer all over the place. And it was so damn foggy, we couldn't make good counts. We occasionally, if fog would lift, and we could get composition, you know, the sex and age ratios, the numbers of yearling in a group, and the numbers of calves in a group, and the numbers of females versus males. Mostly in the summer, the males are separate. The big males are separate. And so you'd get some of that information on the groups that you could see, but when we'd get in a position where we could see big areas, the fog was too dense for us to make counts. So we did, and the weather was not great. It was very rainy and windy sometimes. Very rainy there is... it wasn't really hard rain, but it's wind's blowing so hard that it seems much worse than it is. And rain gear, you got to have really super good rain gear, or the water's going to get in. So it was tough going, and but we had that same driftwood shelter, which was gradually, the beach was gradually encroaching, being eroded away, and it was slumping now. Because a portion of it had been undercut by a storm at some time. And summer is normally not big storms. But we could still use it, and you could use a wood stove in it and pick up driftwood, and it was convenient. We could dry out our wet clothes easily and be warm and dry. And so we did hikes and... with groups, and I think Bud and Fay and the two fisheries guys stayed there and doing their fishing work around Big Lake and the sea, and the rest of us, that would have been 1, 2, 3, 4, I think, of us, maybe 3, I forgot, and would hike up, and that we tried to systematically to make counts. But we were frustrated. You know, we thought, you just can't wait. We had limited time. And we tried to get far enough around to make camps. But I was able to visit the enclosures and work through that, look at the changes that had taken place. And already in those 63, that's what, 6 years.
Yeah.
Already the problems with the exposures were that that's in a marine environment. A lot of these wire, and especially where they went around the iron posts, and where everything was rusted, and the iron, the wind action working the wire at some places, so the wire was fracturing. The main problem, though, was when the bull reindeer were cleaning off their antlers on the wire. In one case, they got stuck there and damaged that enclosure, knocked the fence down and trampled that area. But everything was, the lichens had been so badly damaged and frequently gone when we built the enclosures that in 6 years we couldn't expect anything. It was too short a period of time. But we were able to do follow up work with on the enclosures and the plots. And we got around the island, but we never were able to get a count. It was very frustrating. And the boat that had dropped us off there was a Coast Guard a Navy icebreaker. I think it was a North Wind, an icebreaker. And it had two helicopters aboard. So finally, the day that we're due to be picked up, we were keeping contact either directly by radio with them or with the Fish and Wildlife Office at Bethel, and they would relay on to the icebreaker. So things were pretty much on schedule, and gradually the time was coming when they were going to get back, and we still hadn't been totally frustrated. The day they arrived, we had the best weather. It was still overcast, but it was high overcast, no fog. And so when they came, I got on and I started talking to them on the radio from shore. I said, I wanted to talk to the captain. We're really in a bad way. We've done these studies, and there's just lots and lots of reindeer here, but we haven't been able to get a count. Is there any way we could get use of the helicopter and to do a survey? And he came back within just minutes. It was relayed from the radio operator and said, yeah, we can make both of them available. Mm-hmm. So they flew these two helicopters over, picking up our gear, and then they used the helicopter to put our gear back to the boat. And then Bud Fay got in one helicopter, I got in the other, and we divided the island in half. He took the south half of the island, I took the northern half. And I had one thing to do up at the northern place was the archaeologists here at the university wanted me to do a quick trench across an old foundation site from what looked like it to be a Eskimo foundation site, the only such place on the island, which had been seen by early explorers to the island. And I'd seen it in 1957 and hiked up through there in 1963 when the group of us were, but we didn't have time to stop, and we didn't have the shovel or anything like that. So I took the shovel and I knew it was a sandy material that filtered in there, and the archaeologist wanted me to just run a quick trench across. Mm-hmm. And so I got in, and the helicopter pilot said, well, I can't really afford to keep the engine running while I'm waiting for you, and I can only shut down for about 25 minutes and be sure we can get it started again. And so that's the only time you have. So I dug this quick trench across and just sort of filtered through the sand as I was doing it with the shovel I had in. And I found some pottery shards and I got down to the pavement of the rocks, which were apparently the floor, and I saw there was some charred place where there'd been a hearth, and I found a polar bear tooth, and that's about it. No wood, and where's a couple of big whale bones that were obviously used in the construction of the place from a giant whale, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of other bones, which suggested that the people that were there had killed a whale and maybe got stuck there or something. But that was an aside. We then got back in the plane and both Bud and I did these surveys with the helicopter, which was just pretty ideal. And it was good weather. It's bright sun, you get shadows and everything when you see a group. It's hard to estimate numbers. Still hard to estimate numbers when there are big groups. So we tried to do the best we could and estimating numbers in big groups and counting smaller groups. And we got back then on the boat and put our data together, and we came up with approximately 6,000.
Wow.
So then that was it for,
So that was again, was in the, what, like July, August?
Yeah.
Same 2 to 3 weeks?
Same general period.
Yeah. And did you have your own graduate students with you?
I think it was because Bud Fay was there, and there was a limited number that we could get on the Coast Guard boat to get out there. And then we had these fishery people, I didn't need a grad student, and I didn't have any grad students that were working on.
So it was just you and Bud, the fishery guys, and the BIA?
Yeah, okay.
So five people total?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So then, I wrote up.
So, did you see differences in the enclosures and the vegetation in those 6 years?
Not significantly, because this was mostly the kind of vegetation that had been grazed heavily. The big impact of the reindeer was mostly, you can do this on the outside of the enclosures. There was a little bit if there were. There's one prostrate willow that they would, where the lichens were thickest, there would be these hummocks with prostrate willows. And then there would be very little else in between them except lichens. So the lichens would be this thick, never been grazed.
4 inches.
Yeah, and the bottom two-thirds was dead and decomposing lichens. The top would be live lichens. Mm-hmm. And so it's very vulnerable to overgrazing, because when the decomposing lichens, if they're moist at all, and the reindeer when they're feeding on them, they just would pull up all of the living material, because they'd break off with this dead mm-hmm. material. So there wasn't anything left to start growing, except that in the wintertime, normally, as they're eating, the fragments of the lichens fall down on the snow. And that can start new lichens if it's living material after the snow melt, if they fall in a place. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a way lichens can get restarted. But then we found these windrows of lichens by these beech ridges where they hadn't thawed out yet, because there was so much snow mixed with lichens from the grazing effect. It mm-hmm. loosened all this stuff, and there were lichens mixed in with all this stuff. So a lot of the lichens were just blown out to sea. Mm. The fragments of lichens while they were being grazed. So by 63, the lichens had just been virtually eliminated as a winter food source for the reindeer. But the population was still increasing, not as fast, and the body size had declined again. Declined in 57. The body size were much bigger than the original reindeer from Nunavak, where they came from. And but by 63, they were down to Nunavak Island size, and the calf ratio, calf cow ratio had dropped, and the yearling ratio to adults had dropped. So the body, there had been a decrease in body size, and but they were obviously, since they were about the same size as Nunavak, they were still reproductive and capable of expanding, but they haven't. They had the rate of their increase. You know, they had mild winters, and then the winter of. And this was a follow-up study that we were able to determine that there was a big die-off, which occurred in late winter. That would have been 1964, right after we'd made the summer count of 6,000. Mm-hmm. There was an extreme storm event that caused record-breaking combination of winds, extreme winds, 80 miles an hour, and snowfall measured at the Pribilofs, which was 250 miles southeast, and record snow, and temperatures. Normally, when it snows in those areas, in the marine environment, the temperature is up in the 20s or so. Mm-hmm. The temperature was down around 10, plus 10, I think, or even colder. And so there's an extreme storm event, and it stayed cold, and it stayed, and we were able, some of this we learned later, mm-hmm. more recently, stayed cold. We were able to, and the Coast Guard had been there in 65, and they stopped to let some of the crews go ashore and hunt reindeer because there were so damn many reindeer known to be there. And they had done that when the reindeer were numerous, but not before they got to 6,000. And they couldn't find any reindeer to shoot, and they found lots of skeletons all over the place. They saw a few fresh tracks in one area. But other than that, there was just skeletons scattered all over the landscape. Mm. And so this was in the summertime, when they were there, of 65. And so word got back, and then I thought, oh man, I got to get out there and try to find out what happened and why are there any left, what's the status of the situation, vegetation, condition of the animals, who died when, and when they died. So we went out in 66, three of us. There was a botanist, Vern Harms from Fairbanks, was a botanist at the time here.
What was the...
Vern, V-E-R-N-H-A-R-M-S.
Okay.
And a postdoc that I had from Germany, Detlef, D-E-T-L-E-F, Eisfeld, E-I-S-F-E-L-D, and I, three of us. And we got taken out there by a Coast Guard boy tender and a navigation light on it. They were managing and refurbishing navigation light. And that was a pretty rough trip. We flew, I think, to pick up the boat to the Dutch Harbor or Adak, and then went from there. And it was pretty stormy. But again, I didn't have any problem, but the Vern and Detlef got real seasick. They didn't feel good until we get their feet on St. Matthew. And we did, and They dropped us off, and we had a radio then. And we had lighter radios with these, what was called silver box, the ones that were designed for the stream guards in Alaska coastal areas, came with an antenna you could string up, and it was dry cell batteries, and they just had extra dry cells, and you had to be conservative about using the radio, but you could listen and then make contact and try to keep it short so that you wouldn't run out of power for two batteries. And so we were keeping in touch with the Coast Guard boat, often relaying from, and they were going up all the way up Bering Strait to Forest Point Lay, turning around and coming back. And so they were picking us up late August, scheduled to pick us up in late August, well, about the 20th or so, I don't remember exactly. And then the word was, by radio, they're running behind schedule. So they might be as much as a week late. Well, figured, well, what do you do? I mean, a week isn't such a long time. And we were getting short on food, but we were camped on another lake further toward the midpoint of the island and further north, and it was, we could catch char there right in next to our tent, a nice lake with good water, and we had a wall tent. The other hut had long since washed away by wave action. So it was mainly Detlefs and I working, although Vern sometimes we hiked together, but he was collecting plants. And so he was trying to find different types. But we did long hikes. We usually did it together. Although Detlef and I did one together at the north end of the island. The weather was generally pretty good, and compared to 47 and 63, but
57.
Yeah. And then, but it took us a long time to find the remaining reindeer. Yeah. And they were down south near this big lake, and we, first, Detlef and I hiked down there, and it was like about 7 miles there, and it's foggy, and we were planning to eat some of these. We had a permit for 10 reindeer, but we thought we knew we'd be okay with it if there were no reindeer left, and we had a fish net too, and we were catching fish in that lake close to where our tent was, and lots of driftwood there, so we had a good stove, and it was a pretty good camp. And as we were coming down the hill toward Big Lake, we just fog lifted enough to, oop, there's some reindeer, we had 3 or 4 reindeer. And so we quickly shot 3, I think it was, and I think 3. And so, but there was more than 3 there, but we didn't know how many, because they disappeared in the fog as soon as we shot these other 3. So we quickly butchered Ochot's head and salvaged meat, and the foxes were right there. And we got all of the stuff we needed. And it turned out there were 2 females and 1 male that looked like a female. It had reduced antlers and shrunken testes. But otherwise in good physical condition. And so then we packed meat back to our camp, and we had some rock salt, so we could put some of it in a rock salt and hang it in the gunny sacks up on a big tripod that the foxes couldn't climb, although they tried to. Couldn't climb. And so that was important because we found some of the reindeer, and there were reindeer left, and but we knew that there were more. So then we spent more time looking for the rest. And finally, Detlef and I went down there again, that general layer, and all the way down to the southernmost part, hiked around, and did we camp? I think we might have camped overnight, a small tent, and then although both of us, he was built like me, and we were good hikers. We covered a lot of ground, and it was always, you know, going light, and you don't have to camp, you could still cover a lot of ground. I think we stayed overnight one night, and we were pretty light. We just had the one pot, and we used driftwood, I think, to cook on. And then finally, about 4 in the afternoon, on the opposite side from Big Lake, and the opposite side where we'd seen these others, but in the same broad expanse of a valley, we spotted the remaining reindeer, which we were later verified they were the remaining there. So there were 39 reindeer left, I guess, after we shot 3. So there were 42 in total left, which we learned later. So here were the remaining reindeer, and they were grazing out in this big sedge meadow, and it was really hard to get close enough to shoot. But we spent a lot of time watching them with binoculars, and I think we had a spotting scope. And we concluded that they were all females. There were no young animals, no yearlings. And so we... finally, then I figured, well, we gotta get our sample of 10. So I was able to wiggle on my belly and get close enough, and shot 7 of them. And so I got these 7 reindeer laying on the ground, and it's late in the day, and so we went to work. And boy, that's hard work because you're on your back, you know. And we had to weigh all of these. We were weighing them all. But you had to cut them into chunks big enough, small enough, that you could weigh them with the spring scale that we packed.
Right.
It wasn't too heavy. So I had to weigh them all and get... And we're collecting... Now we're collecting ovaries from all of the females, and verified that all that we shot were females. So we shot... The 7, they were all females, and we're pretty convinced that the remaining ones were females because we watched them closely for quite a while. And then we salvaged some of the meat, but we were a long ways from our tent camp. But both of us loaded up finally after we did all these measurements and collected lower jaws. We took a lot of liver and heart, which you can eat right away, so we had a pretty loaded packs, and then we took off, and we walked all the way back, and that we figured that we covered 22 miles that day, and we had the longest stretch was with the heavy packs on their back, but we made it back. And of course, day length is long,
right.
And not as long as here, but it was long, and so we made it back. And it was pretty good hiking, except there you got hard ground, but you're going up, and then you're going down, and then you're going up over low mountains. And we we made it back to camp, and then the big adventure finally came up. So we'd accomplished our objectives. We'd get the samples. We counted what we're pretty sure this was on. When we did the, went north camp, we found no fresh sign and no very little sign to begin with, and no sign of there were reindeer up in that area. And so at any rate, we're pretty convinced this was the case. But then about that time we learned by our radio contact, which we had about every other day in the evening and with the Bethel office, that the Coast Guard was being delayed. And then by the time we got back, we had heard they had not have been delayed, but they had to stay up there longer than they had anticipated because they were Point Lay was where they're going to turn around, and there had been a Air Force big double engine, or three engine, or four engine Air Force plane that had attempted to land there and crashed in the sea. Everybody was killed, but the airplane was in the sea off the coast, and the Coast Guard had been asked to stay up there and drag for the rain for the aircraft. And so they said, we'll be delayed probably a month.
A month?
As much as a month. And of course, they didn't know how long they'd be. And this is the Coast Guard. They got to do their thing.
Right. And
so they said, well, we can probably get you an airdrop of food. And I thought, a month, this was a disaster for Vern Harms had a classes to teach.
Yeah, that puts you into September.
Pardon?
That puts you into September.
Oh, yeah. And he wouldn't be back in time for his classes and everything. And he had a family, too, in Fairbanks. And so did I. I didn't have a teaching responsibility that semester, but I wanted to get back. I got other plans. And Detlef, it didn't make too much difference, but yeah, he wanted to get back too. He had a wife back there in Fairbanks. I figured maybe there's some other way of getting off. And so we got all the Fish and Wildlife off and said, could they relay to Anchorage, to the aircraft division? We knew they had a Grumman Goose, twin engine Grumman Goose, that had been outfitted to fly long distances and equipped with the proper radio and everything. And it was just brand new. Gone over and equipped with this and tested. And so I knew the head of aircraft division then, and because he'd been there a long time. He was a good guy. And so I said, relayed a check with him, and would it be possible for them to fly out and pick us up? And so they had to relay this and said, then the response was they had to, had to think this over. In the meantime, the Coast Guard is wanting to make an airdrop with food so we can stay out there for a month. Well, we were down a little low, but we didn't want an airdrop because they all wanted off the island. And so we don't need an airdrop now, and we're looking into other possibilities. And but the captain of the boat definitely wanted to give them a list of what kind of food we want in the airdrop. So I said, well, we don't really want. Well, then just provide the list. And the radio, this was all through the radio operator, and I just, didn't want to give him a list because I didn't want to airdrop as long as there was some hope. And we also had asked if they could fly up with an albatross from Kodiak.
What's an albatross?
It's a big double-engine amphibious plane. which they had, we knew they had. And they said, they had to relay that. I mean, they couldn't.
And that was a Coast Guard plane.
Yeah. So they had went through authorities down there, and they said that they could do it, except that they would have no way of picking us up, because all they had was a small inflatable boat, and that wouldn't be adequate to get ashore, because there's wave action there. A Zodiac, but they didn't have Zodiacs that size on the plane. And so at least they considered it. And then we heard back from Fish and Wildlife and said, no, it was too long a distance to try out this new plane. They didn't want to risk the new plane.
Right.
And so we'd been turned down twice, and we're very dejected now, sitting in the tent, and we're down, getting pretty low on coffee, and we had plenty of rice, and we had rice, and not much oatmeal left, and we were catching fish, but some days we wouldn't, if the weather was, the wave action influenced whether we catch fish or not. Some days we'd get 5 or 6, and they weren't as big as in Big Lake, but they were good. And
18 inches long.
So if you get 6, that was good for us, three people, and with a little of this other stuff. But we didn't know what would happen. And now we had to stay by the radio all the time, because we were trying to figure out all these things, and we couldn't hike all the way down and see if we could find them. Technically, we didn't have a permit to take more than 10. Right. And there hadn't been a decision as to what should happen. But I knew that I shouldn't take more, because that the population was going to probably go to extinction anyway, because there's no viable males, and there were no young animals there, so they weren't breeding. Yet the body condition of these females, the last females we killed, was good, with good, putting on good fat. And so at any rate, we were sitting in the tent, and the weather was turning out to be pretty nice. You know, there were breaks in the clouds, and the clouds were lifting, and sun was shining through, and there was no wind. It was pretty nice. And we hear the engine of an aircraft. And it was a small engine, like a small aircraft, not a big aircraft. And we went outside, and it comes out down through a hole in the clouds, comes this super cub on floats. Now, it's 250 miles to the mainland from there.
Wow.
And you don't fly in a super cub out over the open ocean like that. And so it comes out through the clouds and comes down over our camp, wiggles the wing, turns around and lands the lake and pulls up on the beach. And it's got written on the side, Butch, or was it Red? Butch something or other. I think it was Butch somebody or other, or it was Red something or other. Red Butcher, maybe. And this young pilot with red hair climbs out, and there's a nice beach there. It's gravelly beach, and he just pulled right up with the floats, and you could just kind of step off the floats onto the beach, and that was just ideal weather for him too. And the lake is a good lake. It was long enough, and that was we knew it was pretty sure it was deep enough with no rocks, whereas Big Lake was somewhat questionable for landing on a plane. It was bigger, but it was shallower. So at any rate, he climbs out, and he says, oh, help me unload this gas. I've got to refuel. So the back seat was just loaded with these gas cans. So he had flown from Bethel and then landed in the bay out on Nunavak Island and refueled there. And then he flew the rest of the way with the remaining stuff, so he'd have enough fuel to refill and fly back to the mainland. So he comes out on the beach, you know, hi, and introduced there, and says, well, how did you know we were here or something? He said, what brought you out here or something like that? And he said, oh, I heard that there were a lot of reindeer out here, and I'd never been out here, and I thought, and lived in Bethel for several years, and I thought, yeah, that'd be a nice deal to fly out here, and I wasn't busy, and it turned out he had heard that we were on, that there was a camp on the island from Fish and Wildlife in Bethel, I guess, and I don't think he knew exactly where we were, but he just sort of lucked that he came to this one good landing lake. And, you know, when he flew from Nunavak, the clouds were so low and there was fog, he had to go on top.
Wow.
And I thought, man, going on top. And I said, well, how'd you find the island? How'd you know where the island was and find the island? And he said, well, I figured I knew where it was on the map, and I figured I'd see the mountains sticking up through the clouds, because the cloud layer was so low. And that's what he did. But
and it worked.
It was breaking up, providing opening, so right. He didn't have to come down through the clouds to the sea level. And so he, you know, everything worked out the way he had planned it. And so we told him our sad state and that we're stuck there. And he said, well, why don't you get an outfit in Dillingham that they have Grumman Gooses that they fly to the Pribilofs. They should be able to fly out here. And so he says, yeah, I can take one of you back too, because I'm going to have the back seat open after we put all the gas in. And I thought, I talked to both of them outside the tent when he was going down to check something on the plane, and I said, personally, I wouldn't go back. But Vern Harms, he said, oh, no, I want to go back, and because I got to be there for the class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I figured, well, it's up to you to make that decision. And so he told he'd like to go back with them. And then this guy said, well, as soon as I get airborne, I'll radio, and I can make radio contact with Dillingham and see if I can line up a charter for you for maybe the next day. And I said, well, yeah. Yeah. And so then he took off. He said it'll be about 5 hours before he gets back to Bethel. And it was by this time around noon. So we had a snack and they took off. I think he had his own lunch they brought with him, maybe shared it. And they took off and flew. And then the plan was, once they got in, the first thing he did would be to call the Fish and Wildlife Office and tell them what the situation was on the charter, mm-hmm. and also that you successfully made it.
Right.
and we would be on standby with the radio. We were going to be on standby anyway with the Fish and Wildlife at around 6 or 6:30 in the evening. So they would call us. And so they took off. And the weather stayed nice. It kept getting nicer, in fact. The clouds started disappearing. Sunny skies. And it was the best day we had experience on St. Matthew. And so they didn't call, you know. They 5 o'clock came, and they didn't call. And and finally we got in touch with the Fish and Wildlife Office at 6, whatever it was, 6:30 or something, and they said, no, they hadn't received any phone call from them. And, we were getting worried. And so then their phone rang, and he said, oh, just a minute. They made it. Okay. They were so hungry, they stopped and had a hamburger before they called. And he was able to arrange for a charter with this airline in Dillingham, and they said that they would be able to fly up the next day, but they would need a weather report from us, what the weather was like, and they would fly to Bethel, refuel there, and then fly from Bethel out, because it was shorter than going all the way from Dillingham to start with. And so, man, and so we had a weather forecast with the Coast Guard for 7, I think it was. So this is about 6:30, and I figured now I'll just call off this airdrop. Mm-hmm. No airdrop. And I told him that I'd let him know about the airdrop that evening. And so it just kind of hang up from talking to Fish and Wildlife and Bethel, and we hear an airplane. It's a big airplane. And suddenly, and there's still a few clouds, and suddenly down, and the clouds are higher, down out of the clouds come this big Air Force plane with 4 engines, with a big cargo kind of plane. Uh-huh. The back opens up and comes down right over our camp and dips the wings and disappears back up into the clouds again. Well, Detlef couldn't figure out what was going on. He says, where are they going? I says, look, they're verifying, and they had to be sure where we were, and then they had to look over the lake. No, they're not going to land in the lake. They're not going
to
land.
They're not going to land. They have to figure out where to drop it.
And so they had to make a big circle, a big plane like that, and they disappeared into the clouds, made a big circle, and finally we heard them, and then we saw them come out of the clouds again. And then out of the back of this plane comes this parachute and this huge airdrop, and it on a 4x8 piece of plywood. It was stacked up, sea rations and all kinds of crap. And what we said we wanted, protein, and radio operators said, what's that? I says, cheese and maybe dried sausage, stuff like that, summer sausage, and oatmeal and rice, I think. And comes this kneel down, crash right on the beach, far enough where it wouldn't drop on us, but it was this perfect drop. And there's this big cargo net, and there's a big deal on it that says, this must be returned to Eielson Air Force Base. And so and I looked in there, and there's sacks of sea rations and cans, big cans, military cans of ham that, and on the outside said, keep refrigerated. Well, they were a can, but they probably would have kept for a long time. But they were these big cans like this. And then there was a limited amount of oatmeal and a limited amount of rice. I don't think there's any cheese. But at any rate, there was this huge number of sea rations. And so then I rushed back to the tent and got on the radio. And so I was beginning to see some of the humor in this. You have to. And so finally got hold of the direct, the Coast Guard boat. A good connection. And so I was talking to the radio operator there, and I said, first thing, call off the airdrop. We don't need it. We've got to arrange to get picked up. And so he says, well, okay, just a minute, I'll go to the captain. And he comes back and he says, I think it's too late. And then I agreed with him. It was too late. So I told him we tentatively had this scheduled to be picked up. And so then that was set for them. And so they didn't have to think about picking us up, we hoped. But we were still have radio. And the next morning we got up and it was so beautiful weather, and we gave the weather report. And so they said they'd probably be in about 1 p.m. And it goes.
Right.
I'm sure that it took them a while to load up the plane and...
Longer stop in Bethel.
And then have a stop in Bethel, and they'd arranged, I'm sure, to get the fuel, but it's not that simple, and they weren't used to that. And so, I just relayed this information to Detlef that they thought they would be here by 1, but don't count on it for sure. But it was so beautiful, and we just kept waiting to see a big storm brewing on the horizon. And, 1 came, and 2 came, and 3 came. And, I'd look out there, and there would be a seagull way out there. Or Detlef would see it, and then get the binoculars. No, there was a gull. Or then, finally, here comes this plane. It's way out, and it's paralleling the whole island. And it's way out there. You can see it. It's a Grumman goose. I could with the binoculars. I think he had them too. And it just went right on by. Didn't change course at all. And Detlef said, they missed us. How will they ever find us? Their instructions were we are so many miles from the north end of the island. So they had to go to the north end and then count the miles coming back. Mm. And so that's what they did. And so they landed in the lake. There was just 1 guy, a pilot, and he landed in the lake and taxied right up there, put the wheels down with hip boots on. We could wait out. And he just unloaded these big 50-gallon drums of fuel.
Oh.
And then we had to pump those in. And then they could take them back afterwards. But and then we loaded all of our gear and all of this food drop.
I was going to ask.
And the net, because there was plenty of room in the plane. And the Grumman Goose with just 2 of us in our gear and camp and stuff. And took off around 5:30 or so in the evening. And after we'd fueled up, and took off, and I asked the guy if we could make a run down over that area where the reindeer were last seen, where we last shot those, and we did, and it was just perfect weather, and sure enough, they were in the same general area, the remaining, 32 or something? Yeah, 32 animals, right? And they hadn't moved somewhat, but yeah, there they were, and we didn't see any sign of them. Of reindeer in any other places. So that was a good confirmation. And so then he said the original plan was we'd fly to Bethel, refuel, then go to... He said, now the weather's so good and now we can fly direct to Dillingham. So we did. And we got there just as it was getting dark. And you could see the lights of the... just turned on the lights on the airport. And so we got there, and the next day we could catch a flight to Anchorage and then on to Fairbanks. And then I had to drive that Tiles and give it back to the Air Force.
Did they even care?
I didn't give them we saved for the wildlife unit, the sea rations for students to use when they're in the field, and the hams too. But even the hams, you know, when that came down, I said, well, let's open one of those hams right away. I said, we can't eat that whole thing. We want to wait. And finally, he was so hungry, I figured, no, we got to do it. He ate a hell of a lot of ham.
Yeah.
We weren't that hard up, but we weren't eating heavy because we knew
right.
we might be there for a long time.
And he was a young graduate student.
Right.
But the Coast Guard didn't care about getting that food back?
It wasn't the Coast Guard. They probably got the Air Force to put the whole thing together, and they volunteered to do it. And a rescue type of thing like that is...
They don't care about getting it back if you don't use it?
No, especially when it's out in a remote place and takes fuel and everything to get it back. I mean, they wouldn't... If we just said we couldn't get on the plane and left it there, that wouldn't have bothered them.
Hmm. But I thought the fact that you were able to bring it back, they maybe said, oh, well, okay, we'll reuse it for something else.
No, this was... There might have been a few things, but I figured we could use it for students and the wildlife unit, and that would be okay.
Did they appreciate that you brought the net back?
Oh, definitely, yeah. But I don't know whether we met... The person I met... was an officer, and he didn't have a clue other than what... And so they thanked me, but... it was a combination of the Coast Guard. You know, they were in an awkward bind. They were scheduled to pick us up and couldn't, and they had a good reason for not, and so they did their best. They just... made the airdrop before, but they were probably taking advantage of the good weather.
Right.
And the Air Force probably said the same thing.
Right.
It was good weather, it may not last. If it had been super cloudy, they couldn't have made an airdrop.
Right. Well, it was also, you know, in the old days, before all those Arctic exploration trips, that's what happened. The ship couldn't come because the ice was in, or...
Yeah.
So, you're supposed to be picked up, and a month goes by, and then 3 months, and then they're all starving. So they didn't want that to happen to you guys.
But this Super Cub, you know, that was comes out of the blue.
Yeah. Was that Red Boucher?
No.
No.
No. I've got his name written somewhere.
Yeah. When you said Red, I thought, well, maybe.
Well, I seem to remember he has red hair, and maybe it was Red something or other. And he was a... guide outfitter.
Out of Bethel?
Yeah, had his own plane out of Bethel. Hmm. And he was just a nice young guy. And that was kind of an adventure he was looking for.
Yeah.
Coming out.
So, wow.
But he was, it was just, I mean, he was on the ball. He said, well, why don't you charter a plane from Dillingham? They've got Crum and Gooses, the company, and fly to the Pribilofs, and then he said, well, as soon as I'm airborne, I can probably line
nice.
It up.
Good idea.
It was just ideal, because he had, if he'd gone and waited someone to call from Bethel, but if you're in an airplane, and you're direct contact with and he could get direct contact with the other airline company, it was just perfect.
Yeah. Well, so... from 57 to 66, that's when the reindeer all declined. What happened to your enclosure vegetation studies in those time periods?
The vegetation studies, it was still too soon to see much of a difference. And when Detlef and I did that hike, we stopped and checked those enclosures, and you couldn't see much significant difference. Well, then I published one paper on this whole thing in the Journal of Wildlife Management in 1972 or 73, I think. and including analysis of the ovaries showing that the females had ovulated normally but had not conceived, and which verified that the male was not viable, but the absence of young animals also suggested that, that the, all the females were had been either yearlings or a year older, so they were very young and probably didn't have, weren't carrying an embryo. We were able to determine the time of the major die-off by looking in these carcasses where females had died and the bones of the embryos were there. And so figured that that was February and early March that most of them died. Well, February mainly. And so, and that, you know, then the, of course, then the paper went into why the males died and the females, some females survived, significant number out of 6,000, but probably no pregnant females survived. And these were animals in good condition, good enough condition that they made it through this tough, extreme long period of deep snows, bad weather, and poor food available. Mm-hmm.
So why is it that the females survived better than the males?
Okay. Then you go back to the old polygamy and the strategy of polygamous animals where males breed more than one female. And the males have to gain, well, in caribou, that the reindeer are models for, the males have to be dominant over other males to hold a harem of females. And the reason for holding the harem together is when the females come into estrus and it's not in perfect synchrony, then they breed these females. So if you can hold a bunch of females together, and moose do the same thing, then you can breed the females. But you've got to be a big, dominant male. And if you so young males don't get to breed, usually. And the big, dominant males, they got, they're super fat going into the breeding season, and they burn all that fat up. They don't eat very much, if anything, because they're so focused on breeding the females. And they then expend all this fat that they've accumulated, whereas the females go on putting on fat during the breeding season, and they concentrate on feeding on the optimal food that's available for putting on fat, because their contribution to reproduction is not achieved until they produce a young, nurse it, and wean it, and see it until it is separated from them.
So the females need that fat to produce viable young.
To survive themselves through the winter in good enough condition to not only produce a viable offspring, but to lactate enough milk.
Right.
The greatest physiological demand on the female is not in the terminal stage of her gestation and the development of the embryo. Yeah, it increases, but it's not like it is once she has to start producing all that milk, because that new fawn, her calf, is growing, going to be growing like hell, faster than it was when it was in her. And so she has to feed on optimal food that's screening up now, and be very selective for just the highest quality, quick digesting food, and literally eat and digest and produce milk until for the first 3 weeks of the life of the calf before it's getting into starting to graze, and they go, she'll go on nursing it for longer than that. But the peak production of milk is in this period when the calf is getting big fast and demanding a lot of milk and dependent on that milk. Gradually you'll start learning to eat some of the new vegetation and digesting some of that and still nursing, and gradually right. The nursing drops off and the vegetation consumed goes on. And right up into the nursing is usually over by, major nursing is over by late August.
And they have their calves when?
Well, caribou would have their calves in first week of June in northern Alaska, but the reindeer have their calves 2 or 3 weeks earlier.
Mm, okay.
So there's one reindeer was born already, calf here.
Oh, at the large animal farm?
Yeah, no, down at the ones down by the...
But the university's reindeer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So back to these, the males died off.
No, that was in Gulfstream Valley. There's somebody there that has a reindeer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The reindeer.
He, that was into his paper.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And a picture of the guy and the calf and the reindeer.
Yeah, cool.
You know the people?
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah. Doug and Jane.
What is it?
Doug Toley and Jane. Maybe it's different people. Don't worry about it. You can't get up. You're connected.
No, I can't. I've already stuck it in the mailbox for
now. Anyway, just to finish off St. Matthew Island, the males died off because they had burned up their caloric reserve, and then the bad winter hit, and they didn't have anything to rely on.
They hadn't been able to rebuild their body condition enough.
So they were more susceptible to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the same down in southeast when I was working with deer, we find that. Plus males down there, and a lot of males would, during the rutting season, quite a few males would turn up that they'd swimming across between islands and would die, and they would risk it, and so then they'd show up on the beach, and they wouldn't be, later in the winter, you might get animals forced into the water they'll go in the water and they'll just stand out there where the wolves can't get at them. And whereas during the rut, that's when you occasionally would see a male swimming to another island where there are more deer, more females, and to try to breed more females. Taking risks. Men do that, young men. Taking
it's
risks.
It's not all species, they do that, huh?
Well, then humans, there's heavier mortality on males than females. And so a lot of that, in these herd animals where there's one male is normally dominant and in a given area, and they keep the other males away, and if they're successful, eventually they may get displaced. Especially caribou bulls will maybe get to breed, big bulls maybe get to breed a few females, but if they have to get into any tussles with other males, pretty soon the other males, another big one comes along and displaces it.
Mm-hmm.
And for moose, that can happen too. They get in a big tussle, it takes so much out of them.
Right.
And then they often, if one of them is displaced, it goes and lays down in the thick willows where bears or something won't locate them and stay there until they can recover a bit before they go out. But they're probably through by then.
Then they've lost their chance, kind of. With the female.
Yeah, that's true. They may have lost their chance, but they've already probably bred several females. And then sometimes if there's not another, both males are tired, then there's a chance for young males to come in. And they stay on the opposite side of these big males and try to breed. And musk oxen, you can see the same kind of behavior.
So I just want to, you mentioned on the lichen that it wasn't a long enough time period to see the changes in the vegetation. And that's just because the growing season is so short, so it takes years to see any change in an undisturbed area.
Two publications follow. One, in 1985, I went out with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they wanted me to, and I was eager to go. They were providing, they had chartered a crab boat and were going to do other bird stuff. And they took me out and were able to look at the vegetation plots and do analysis and photo analysis as well as direct analysis of changes in composition. And then I wrote a publication on that.
Okay.
And mainly it focused on the differential recovery rates of different lichen species, and was showing that there was had been grazed so heavily that the lichens that were there when it was grazed are no longer there, and it was sort of like starting from scratch. You get pioneering species that aren't as palatable to reindeer at first, or caribou, and then other species coming in. So that was published, a fairly short paper in the Journal of Range Management.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2005, I went again. So that 85 was how many years? That from 1957.
63 was 66 is when you were almost stranded.
Yeah, but 85 was when they went out.
Right.
And that was after we built the enclosures and done the initial work.
Oh, so 57 to 85.
Was how many years? That would be 15 years plus
28 years.
Pardon?
Wait,
no.
You're like 27 years. No, 23 years. I don't care. What is it?
57 and
1985. It's easy if I write it down.
Five.
28.
28 years. Okay, then I went and I did a publication then, mainly on the how the lichens were recovering,
mm-hmm.
and also what effect the willows and mm-hmm. sedges, because they were the sedges were the ones that increased as a result of grazing, where lichens had been, and the willows had been damaged, but not the plants weren't killed, and some of that damaging was because they were eating the current annual growth of the willows, but also and eating the leaves in the summer, early summer, but also pawing for lichens, they might damage some of the willows, but the willows were recovering, and the sedges were inhibited by the lichens in growing, and they came back first, pretty fast. Other plants that came back were forbs, especially ones that the reindeer and caribou love to eat the blossoms of when they're just coming in bloom, like that pink lousewort,
mm-hmm.
and also a legume species that has little blue flowers and seed pods that look like little pea pods, and that's an oxytropis something or other, and but others as well that reindeer were hammering because they're good. sneeze okay. coming on, and so then. Then in 2005, went out again, and then one of the reasons was to look at the plots, which I did, and that was a more thoroughgoing assessment of regrowth, and then the question was, why was it growth of lichens so slow? It should have been much more rapid than it was. And so there's a combination of things. One we already knew that it was, they were slow because of the severe grazing pressure, and there wasn't much living tissue of lichens left, so they had to start from scratch pretty much. Then it gets more complicated, because why were the lichens there in the first place so dominant? And so this led to other work on the Pribilof Islands and a paper there, but following the 2005 expedition. But I did this paper with Martha Shulsky. Do you know her?
Mm-mm.
She was used to be here with the Alaska Climate Office, and she and Word Gendler published a book on the climate of Alaska. Have you seen that?
Don't get up, because you're connected.
All right. So, at any rate.
Yeah, I know the book.
Okay.
So
she worked with me on this paper on the St. Matthew lichens. And what my hypothesis was, the Big Lake lake level had gone way down by 2005. And the growth had been so slow in the lichens. And then I looked for evidence of climate change, mm-hmm. climate warming, and longer summers, and more less fog, and more summers, more sun, which is good for the vascular plants, bad for the lichens. So I was able to do this paper that that climate warming, and Martha reconstructed the weather in the Pribilofs for that, and then another paper on the Pribilofs relative to the St. Paul and overgrazing by lichens, by reindeer. But also I came up with this hypothesis that lichens were sort of a relic of a colder climate. So that in a cold climate, they don't necessarily grow slower or faster. It depends on how much sun they have and how much moisture is available in the air to keep the lichens moist, because they go dormant in 45 minutes in a sunny day.
Hmm.
So if it's been foggy overnight and they're real soft, and you step on them, you know, and they just kind of all swish away, in 45 minutes they crack and break into small pieces, so they dry. And this was pointed out by in the lecture by Randy Jant night before last.
Okay.
On fire ecology. And she, and when she was with the BLM, and also in conjunction with Fish and Game, they put out some Park Service wasn't the two of them, I guess. They put out some enclosures on the Seward Peninsula, the base of the Seward Peninsula, mm-hmm. where the Western Arctic herd was grazing, and in the hills, hills near the Selawik Flats, mm-hmm. Kobuk area, and showing, and their enclosures or plots were 20, when they published the paper on it, it was 25 years. So mine were older, but they were able to check those pretty regular and show that they didn't have exposures, they had plots. And so they could look at effect and change, and the caribou were wintering in that every year to some extent. And they were able to show that the lichens weren't being overgrazed, but the landscape was changing from the gray of gray-green mm-hmm. to green. And this was part of climate warming, with longer summers and drier conditions in the summer, and it, which meant slower growth of lichens. That doesn't mean that the caribou were overgrazing or that the lichens were not growing as fast. They were not growing as fast because they were dormant more in the dry weather. And some studies verifying that were done with reindeer range in Scandinavia mm-hmm. as well.
Okay, cool. Wow.
So that was published in Ambio, mm-hmm. and they did a good job on that. And Martha was good at putting it together. And then there was one more paper, John Waltz and Martha and I were involved in that one. And I asked John at one point, you know, why was that, how do you account for that extreme storm event that killed off the reindeer in 1964? That's a massive die-off in such extreme conditions in the Pribilofs. He said, I don't know, but maybe it sounds like a volcanism, maybe a eruption, some big eruption in the northern hemisphere. He said, I'll just check that out. And I went to the internet and said, no, but there was a big one in Indonesia, in Mount Aegon. And then he said, well, I can probably reconstruct that storm by looking at, there's a lot of data from ships at sea. And that data is barometric pressure. So you can relate barometric pressure to wind and sea conditions. And so he was able to reconstruct this extreme low associated with the eruption and that moved out into the South Pacific up the coast, say it hit parts of Japan, just barely, and then out into the North Pacific, crossing the Aleutians, where the weather stations were showing that there was extreme conditions, extreme storm, as an extreme low. Hmm. At the same time, there was an extreme high, and this was in the winter, so which is not unusual, but it was an extreme high over Eurasia, Russian Far East, and that was moving directly toward St. Matthew Island, and the low met, he was able to show that they met right over, generally over the St. Matthew Islands. Hmm. They accounted for the high frequencies of conditions in the Pribilofs, but they were even more severe. So he could reconstruct the wind velocities that would happen and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so we published a paper in a journal called WeatherWise, so that Martha and John Waltz and I did that. And my position was, to show how small populations on islands or in fractured habitat are very vulnerable to extreme mm-hmm. events, extreme storm events. And John Waltz, his modeling has predicted that extreme events, extreme weather events, are going to happen with climate warming. But they're going to be more intense, like hurricanes, more frequent extreme events, but not necessarily more turtle hurricanes. It suggests that there's going to be more extreme ones,
right,
which certainly has been the case with Sandy. And
right, that's showing to be true.
So that one was a fairly brief paper, but it was amazing that John could put all this together and know where to go. Both of them didn't go to the internet and pull out the stuff. There's vast amounts of data. You got to know how to access it.
Right.
NASA was the one that keeps this ships at sea barometric pressure thing. And every ship at sea reports their position periodically.
Yeah, they have.
And that enters this, and that data is available internationally.
Wow. Very cool. Well, that's great. And I know there's more on the St. Matthew story, but it's getting late, and I can tell you're getting tired, so I think
I can talk forever on St. Matthew, but this is good. This is good that we covered that.
It's been great. So we'll finish St. Matthew the next time.
Yeah, but we won't need to spend too much time on it.
No, but we have to. I mean, I know you were there since 2005, you were there.
In 2012.
Right, so we have to at least cover your last...
That's what I'm working on now, the rocks, and I'm making progress.
And so we have to at least talk about that trip, because I know that was an exciting trip.
Yeah.
So we will start with that next time.
Good.
Okay.